Have you ever noticed there are so many questions we get asked in a day? We get asked so many questions from the moment we wake up to the moment our head hits the pillow. Questions like, what am I supposed to be doing today? Questions like, what do I wear? What should we get to eat for lunch, for breakfast, for dinner? So many questions. What should I do with my life? Some of our questions get a little deeper, and they're like, what's my purpose? We get almost suffocated with the amount of questions that come at us, and they take a toll. Now, there are certain professions that get more questions than others. There are certain professions that get a lot more questions than others. And there was a study that was given in the UK a few years ago that ranked the professions with the most questions asked. Now, can you, on the top of your head, start thinking about what profession would probably get asked the most questions?
Teachers.
Teachers.
Doctors.
Doctors, yeah. Nurses, okay. You're almost there. All right, so the top four, we'll do this like Dave Letterman style. Top four, number four is doctors and nurses. So yeah, doctors and nurses that you would expect to have a lot of questions because people ask questions like, you know, why does it bleed and things like that. You know, like there's lots of questions that go to doctors and nurses all the time. But right ahead of them, more questions than doctors and nurses a day are primary school teachers, which you would expect. And we have some primary school teachers here. Then they're going, so many questions. I told you what to do, but you didn't do it. Right? So you have so many questions. And now remember, this is in the UK. And so what gets more questions than doctors, nurses, and primary school teachers would be the Prime Minister of England, which makes sense. They probably have a lot of things to decide, right? But what gets more questions than doctors, nurses, primary school teachers, or the Prime Minister of England?
Moms.
Or the UK, mums. Is that right, Kate? Yeah. Moms get asked, on average, 300 questions a day. average. Some people are skewing the average. Questions like, probably half of them are, where is blank? And you're like, I told you where to look, right? That moms get so many questions, but they also, in that study, said there were some deeper questions that they were getting asked, like, why is water wet? And you as a mom have to go, well, you have to answer all these questions. And all of these questions that we get asked every single day actually has a cost to you. The more questions you ask, the worse your answers become. There's something called decision fatigue. This is a real thing, decision fatigue. And that is when the more questions you ask, the worse your decisions are. So earlier in the day, you had a really thoughtful answer to those questions. Near the end of the day, you're just going, sure, whatever, yes, is the answer. Because you just have just exhausted by answering all of the life's questions. But what if you were able to have deeper questions answered ahead of time so that when you engaged with all of the questions that come at you every single day, you already have an answer to those questions? And I think life has four big questions that we all have to ask. Every single one of us has to answer these four questions, and these four questions are, who is Jesus? Who am I? Who are my people? And where is my hope? I think these four questions are so foundational that it actually will take care of a lot of questions you have in life when you figure these four questions out. And in fact, actually, these four questions aren't even equal themselves. These four questions, there is one on here that is a keystone question. James Clear, who wrote this book, Atomic Habits, is fantastic. He talks about keystone habits. Things that if you get this habit, it has a cascading effect on the rest of your life. And he found out, like, when I work out, all of a sudden, I start wanting to eat healthier. And when I eat healthier and I'm working out, then I start sleeping better. And then when I'm eating healthier, sleeping better, eating better, I'm actually more productive in life and in my job. And so it's all because of this one habit. It had this cascading effect. I think there is a keystone habits, but there's also keystone questions. And the keystone question on that list, the one that is going to be so foundational that once you get it, everything else falls into place, is the very first question of who is Jesus? Until we answer that question, everything else seems to be up in the air. Who is Jesus? And so my big idea for this sermon here today, when we see Jesus clearly, we see ourselves, our people, and our future differently. So, first point, who is Jesus? Verse 13, Jesus says to his disciples, he has a little powwow with them and says, who do people say that the Son of Man is? He's asking them, you know, what is the word on the street? You guys are interacting with a lot of the crowds. What are they saying about me? And so this is a great position to be in because you get to remain like a neutral observer and just saying like, I'm not actually answering that question personally yet, but here's what the crowds are saying about you, Jesus. If you were to say, Mosaic, if you were to say what our world says about Jesus, who Jesus is, how would you answer that question? Who do people say Jesus is today? A good teacher. Pretty chill. just go with the flow. Okay. Yeah. Well, not all wrong, not all bad, right? The way they answered it, the way the disciples answered it in verse 14, they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets. Now, if you look at that list there, they're not bad things to be associated with. If someone told me you are one of the prophets, like that'd be a high praise to say like I'm on par with prophets of the Bible, right? So they didn't have a too low of opinion of Jesus. They just didn't have a box big enough for Jesus. Like these answers are respectful. Like, yeah, you're a really good teacher. You're chill. You're one of the prophets, right? Right? It was respectful of who he was. And what this tells us is that means you can have a high view of Jesus and still not get Jesus. You can be respectful of the faith and still not get the faith. You can affirm that Jesus existed on this earth and never affirm that he is your Lord. It's not big enough of an answer. And so Jesus now turns the question to the disciples in verse 15. And he says, but what about you? Who do you say I am? Well, now that's getting a little uncomfortable. Now it's getting personal. Who do you say I am? And y'all, this is the ultimate question. This is the keystone question, the question that every other question is now going to hang upon. Who is Jesus to you? And this is a question that your parents can't answer. It's a question that your pastor can't answer for you. You have to be able to answer it. So when Jesus speaks to you and says, who do you say I am? What will you do? What will you say? It's a very much a you question. It's a very much a personal question. But just because it's a personal question doesn't mean it's a personalized answer. And I think sometimes we do that. We like to personalize Jesus and say like, well, here's how I like to think of Jesus. You ever heard someone talk like that? Like, I like to think of Jesus as more like a life coach who just gives me some good tips on, you know, how to be a little more productive. Or I like to think of Jesus as like my emergency contact, so I just reach out when things are tough. And okay, not bad to have a life coach and an emergency contact. Those are important things. But that's not what we're doing here. That's not who Jesus is. That's not what he's giving them. He's not giving them that question. He doesn't ask, what role do I play? He's asking, who do you say I am? And Peter answers in verse 16, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, Peter, we know, does not get the full extent of what he just said. He just said something so profound and so right that it went right over in his own head, because in next week's sermon, you'll hear how Peter gets Jesus very wrong. But today, and in this moment, He says, you are the Christ. Now, some of us, we hear Jesus Christ and we think Christ is Jesus' last name. It's not. You know, Harry Potter, the chosen one. The chosen one's not his last name, right? It's describing who he is. And the Christ is describing who Jesus is. He is the Messiah. He's the deliverer. He is the one that they've been prophesying for hundreds of years. He's come to deliver his people. But when he comes, he doesn't come to kill his enemies. He comes to lay down his life for his enemies. And then Peter says something outrageous and says that he is the Son of God. He is the Son of God. He gives Jesus this divine attribute, which to us in 2026 makes sense. We're like, yeah, that's what Christians believe. Jesus is God. But imagine you're with the disciples there and you're seeing this guy do some miracles and you're going, that's pretty cool. He's filled with the Spirit of God. But are we really ready to say God is walking amongst us? Like, that was a radical claim that Peter makes in this moment, that we cannot just breeze by, that Jesus is God. And if Jesus is God, if Jesus is the Christ, that changes everything. Like, when you have an important event in your life, if you have work tomorrow, if you have school tomorrow, you orient everything around that. You know, starts at 9 a.m., therefore, I got to get everything ready so I can be there at 9 a.m. It ends at this time. And then I know what's happening afterwards. But I've oriented everything around this time, this important event. If I know I'm taking a flight tomorrow and it's at 9, I'm not going to assume the airport is going to adjust to me and say, well, what time would you like to fly? No, you be there ready to go before 9 because you adjust to it. When you have Jesus as the Christ and the Son of God, we don't ask God to adjust to us. We reorient ourselves all to God and say, you are the God, you are the Lord, you are the Savior, and I'm going to adjust to you. Is that how we see Jesus? When you answer the question, who is Jesus, does he carry that much weight? And until we answer that question, all the other questions aren't going to make sense. So first, who is Jesus? Peter answers, the Christ, the Son of God. And on that identity of Jesus, all of Christianity stands and falls. Now, the second question, who am I? Peter answers, Christ, the Son of God, and now Jesus responds in verse 17. He says, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, or son of Jonah. Odd time for us to call up Simon or Peter's dad out in the moment, Jonah. It's like, blessed are you, Ryan, son of Jeff. You're like, oh, why are we bringing my dad's name into this? It's as if, you ever have your parents call you by your full name? First, middle, and last name? Ooh, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's never good. Ryan James Thompson, which is my real name, even though everyone calls me Slim. When my parents said Ryan James Thompson, I knew I was in a lot of trouble. It was usually followed by something like, stop shooting a bow and arrow into the neighbor's fence. Stop. And that happened a lot. Maybe sometimes I missed the fence and went to their house. But, you know, we're not going that direction. But when you use the middle name, when you use those names to draw back on some your deeper identity, it's to wake you up, to say, let me remind you who you really are. Simon Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah. But in this moment, Jesus is not mad at Peter. He's waking him up saying, this is a really important moment, Peter. Listen in. And then he says in verse 18, and I tell you that you are Peter, which in the Greek is Petros, which means rock. And he says, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. So he's saying, you are rock, and I will build my church on this rock. He's emphasizing the foundation that Jesus is laying right now in this moment. And we'll talk about what that means to, I will build my church here in a second. But let's look at what just happened here. Peter just confesses who Jesus is. Peter confesses Jesus' identity. And then immediately, Jesus confesses Peter's identity. It's an interesting turnaround. You are the Christ, the Son of God. And he says, now you're Peter. It's just kind of an odd moment here, unless there's more happening. And I think there's more happening in this moment. I think what's trying to tell us is that we understand ourselves best when we understand Christ rightly. You can understand yourself better when you find yourself in proportion or in position to who Jesus is. And until you know who Jesus is, it's hard to really know who you are. This is what Jesus does for Peter. He doesn't say, Peter, just go and invent your own identity. He tells him who he is. He gives him an identity. And Jesus does that for you and I as well. I think one of the things that we struggle with in our society all the time is our identity. And we wrap our identity in so many things. I think work is one that many people struggle with, is wrapping their identity with. And they say, what do you do? And it really is saying, justify your existence. Your identity is not what you do. Your identity is not how much money you have in the bank. Your identity is not your success or your failures, whether you're single or married. Your identity is not your past. And I don't know if there's anyone here that needs to hear it. Your identity is not your worst mistake. Jesus is not calling Peter by his worst sin and his worst mistake. He commissions him in this moment. And he gives him a new identity. And what does Jesus tell us about our identity as Christians? He's saying that you are sons and daughters of the King. Who am I? I'm a son and daughter of the King. That's who I am, because I know who Jesus is. And that's how I see myself. I'm a son and daughter of the King. And when you realize that, that's going to change the cascading effect to all these other things. And so if you see yourself as a son and daughter of the King, then who are my people? This third point, who are my people? Every time you enter a room, whether it's a new room or a new place or a new job or a new school, we all walk around and we go, where are my people? Who are my people? Does this place have any of my people? And we kind of scan and we go, can I fit? We're all sizing people up, trying to find out who is someone I can click with, I can connect with. And if Jesus is the Son of God, if he is the Christ, that means something. That means my people are Jesus's people. My people are whoever are Jesus's people. Verse 18, he says, I will build my church. My church. Notice he does not say, I will build your church. Nor does he say, you will build my church. Each word there is significant. It says, I will build my church. Let's talk about each of those words there. First, I. We'll include my as well. I and my. Who's in charge? Jesus. The Sunday school answer is the right answer. It is Jesus's church. Who's in charge of this church and every other church? It is Jesus. Not any of us here. We are servants to the King. It is his church. Colossians 1:18 says, he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. And so, whatever we're doing as a church, we have to ask the question, are we following the King, or are we stepping in front of the King and saying, hey, follow us? We need to constantly be asking ourselves, are we reorienting ourselves as a church of who's really in charge? And so it's his church. And then he says, I will build. I will build. I think every church as you walk into should have a sign that says construction zone. Under construction when you walk into the sanctuary here. And if you ever go to drive by a construction zone, I-35, it's a mess, is it not? It's annoying. There are nails everywhere, and you find them in your tires and things like that, right? Construction zones are messy. Jesus is saying, I will build my church. And when you come into a church, you are coming to a place of messy people, in construction, in process. And this does not excuse sin, but it is great news. It is good news for sinners. You are welcome here if you're a sinner. Good news. We're all in the same boat. We all equally need this table before us. We all equally need Christ's body and his blood. So I will build is good news for anyone who's wondering, like, I messed up. I messed up big. And Christ said, I'm not done with you yet. I will build my church. And the last part, church. The Greek word there for church is ekklesia, which means the called out ones. The ones Jesus has taken away from the world to be different from the world. Now, who gets called out? Who gets called out from the world? Is it the elite? Is it those with the status and the money? Here's the wonderful thing about the church and also the annoying thing. God calls anyone. You might be like, man, did he really need to call that person? That's the great news, that God calls anyone. He calls anyone. Romans 10, 13 says this, for whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. I love that verse. Whosoever. Wanted to go with the KJV on that. Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Who? Anyone. Anyone can call on Jesus. In a world today where we're starting to rank like, are you American enough? Have you lived here long enough, which is all crazy relative? Jesus is saying, your relation to the church is your allegiance to me. And so anyone can get on that. Whether your status, from wherever you are born, whether how much money you have, it doesn't matter. You are part of the greater body that I am building here. And our allegiance to Jesus is greater than what is trying to divide us. And in this world today, when the powers that be are constantly trying to divide us between us and them, Jesus is going to create a new us. There is no division here. And the church is going to say, before I'm anything else, I belong to Christ and his people. Because the church is the bride of Christ. That's how he sees you. A bride adorned for the wedding day. And if that's how Christ sees you, I need to put on some different glasses and love the church the way Christ loved the church. Because if Christ is who he says he is, that makes me who I am, and that makes you my people. Because if you are his people, then you're my people. Because we are now joined at the hip. We've all been brought into the family together. So, all of that to say now, where is my hope? The last important question for us to ask in life. Where is my hope? I feel like this is a question I've heard from constantly from our people all the time over the last couple years. It's just like, man, where is their hope? It doesn't seem to be in this world. It doesn't seem to be in any of our leaders. Where is our hope? Jesus says in verse 18, I will build my church. Then he goes on to say, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I think some translations say the gates of hell, and it's actually the gates of Hades will not overcome it. And the gates of Hades is another way of saying death. The gates of death will not overcome or overpower the church. Which is kind of an odd phrasing because gates aren't really overcoming. They're in a defensive position. They're kind of static, right? And so the picture is not the church hiding from death. The picture is the church advancing against a power that cannot ultimately withstand Christ. The picture is the resurrection giving us the church confidence that death itself cannot stop the mission of Jesus. And so our hope is not just to avoid death. We have a bigger hope than that. Our ultimate hope is that death is defeated. And so whatever fears and whatever worries that we have, this is not just pure optimism. Our hope is resurrection hope. If our greatest fear is death, Jesus comes and he dies and he resurrects from the grave, right? And the way 1 Corinthians 15 describes it, it's so violent. It's like Jesus is coming and he's trampling over death by his death. And he walks out of the grave. And when he walks out of the grave, we being united to him, his people, we walk out too. And so we always have hope. There are resurrection and miracles happening all over the place. This is not just one day, someday. We always are going to have hope. And this is what he tells Peter in this verse that sometimes gets really taken out of line. Verse 18, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Now, you could take that to see that Peter is now at the pearly gates of heaven deciding who gets to go in and go out of heaven. I do not think that is the correct interpretation of that passage. I believe what that passage is saying is that Jesus is giving Peter and the disciples the authority to proclaim the message of the kingdom and to declare what Jesus already taught and to say what is true and what is right to live in this kingdom. And that's what we see throughout the book of Acts. And so what that means is our mission as a church is not just to hold on until heaven and just to wait until we get to heaven, because then it'll be made right. Yes, it will be made right then. But our hope is that the kingdom is happening now. He gives Peter the keys now to advance the kingdom now. And so we as a church are going to proclaim forgiveness now, that you can have reconciliation with Jesus now. You can have real hope, tangible hope, today, if we actually answer these questions of who is Jesus, and if Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, you actually can have hope that can actually sustain you through whatever it is that you're walking through in this moment, that there is true hope now and in the world to come. And so the question you have to answer, the beginning question, the keystone question is, who do you say Jesus is? If you can answer, he is the Christ, the Son of God, then you can answer the question about who I am. I'm his. And that his people are my people. And that my hope is an invincible hope that beats death itself. And when you get that first question right, all the other questions fall into place. And so let me give you some practical applications this week, some so what to do this week. I want to give you some homework. I know, first week of school for some of y'all, giving you some homework. The first question is that first thing. I want you to answer, who is Jesus to you? And I don't want you to just answer it in your head going, yes, he's the Son of God. I'm giving you homework. I want you to physically, with a pen, write it down. There is something powerful in writing it out, whether you have a journal or a diary or just a piece of paper. I want you to write the answer to that. Who is Jesus to you? Sometimes in that process of writing, you might reveal something to yourself and say, and when you're actually honest, and go, I don't even know who Jesus is. Or I know the answer. I know what the answer should be, but who do I believe Jesus to be? I want you to be honest about that. Because if you can get that answer, writing it out, like that's going to determine your calendar this week. That's going to determine how you pray this week. That's going to determine how we as Christians deal with our money and our sexuality. It determines everything. So who is Jesus to you? Answer that. And while you're writing, the second one is not the final one, but we're saying, because we're going to do all Fs, final, Jesus gets the final word on your identity. Jesus is going to get the final word on your identity. What he says about you is more important than what someone else says about you or what you say about you. And so, I want you to write out, after you write out who you say Jesus is, what am I tempted to use to prove my worth that Jesus has already settled? What am I tempted to use to prove my worth, to say, no, this is why I'm valuable. This is why I matter. Jesus has already settled it, that you matter, that you are loved, that you're a daughter or son of the King. So first, final, and then lastly, family, because, you know, three Fs. Jesus' people are my people. And so commit to the church. I'm not saying commit to Mosaic, but it'd be cool if you did. Commit to the church. Commit, if God gave his life for this bride, we ought to love it too. And so commit to the church this week. Engage in conversations, reach out to another believer, Ask how you can pray for them, how you can encourage them. Just ask them about them. In committing to the church, you're actually loving and being a part of what God is doing here on this earth. Because once we get Jesus right, this all else is going to fall into place. And then we can say, I know who I am. I know who my people are. I know I have hope upon hope. I have unending hope. And so let's go answer that first keystone question first. Let me pray for us.